Good afternoon and welcome to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg and we're live once more for an hour, as is the case each weekday, as we open our phone lines to take your calls. If you have questions about the Bible or about the Christian faith and would like to ask those here, well, you can do that here. We have 1 hour together and our lines are open right now. There's no calls waiting. You can get right through if you want to. You can also call if you have a difference of opinion you want to discuss. We can talk about that too. Here's the phone number, and you could be the first one to get through at this point. The number is 1-800-438-5090. That's 1-800-438-5090. And Leanna wrote me a question some time ago. She said, "Hi, Steve. I have a question regarding the death of Uzzah, as mentioned in 1 Chronicles 13:10. She says, I don't understand why God was so severe upon Uzzah as he tried to prevent the ark from falling out of the cart he was driving. Can you clear this up for me?" Well, I might be able to. There are some things we're not told. And there are some factors which, if they were in fact present, would make this a little more understandable. The story in its bare narrative is told this way. David was moving the Ark of the Covenant to Jerusalem, where he had built a tent to shelter it, and the Ark of the Covenant represented the presence of Yahweh and his people. So David wanted Yahweh's presence to be signified by the presence of the Ark in the holy city of Jerusalem. So there was a big celebration, a big parade, and the Ark was placed onto an ox cart and was in the process of being taken to Jerusalem when apparently a rough patch of road that the cart hit, actually the oxen stumbled, the Bible says, and apparently the ox cart was, its stability was compromised, and a man named Uzzah, about whom we know nothing else than this, he was there, and he reached out and sought to stabilize the ark so it wouldn't fall off the ox cart. And God was angry at Uzzah for that and actually struck him dead. And this made David even angry at God. He thought, well, God, why'd you do that? Anyway, it prevented the ark from being taken all the way to Jerusalem on that occasion. It was left elsewhere until later. And the question, of course, is why was Uzzah struck down? He sounds like he was just a bystander who, was hoping not to see the ark topple into the mud. It seems like it was out of reverence to the ark that he may have done this. Well, if this is so, it definitely raises serious questions as to why God would be so severe. Now, there are some other factors that could have been present, which I personally think were, but I can't prove it. One is, I believe Uzzah was a priest. Not only was he the priest, I think he's probably the priest who was in charge of the ark getting to Jerusalem. I think that he probably had the custody of the ark, and that's why he was nearby enough to reach out and stabilize it, which probably most of Israel would be keeping, some distance from it as it was being moved. But I personally suspect, I can't prove this, that Uzzah was the priest who was in charge of moving the ark. Now, why would that make a difference? Well, the ark should not have been moved that way. Under the law of Moses, the ark was supposed to be carried on the shoulders of priests. There were two rings on each side of it, and you're supposed to slide these poles through the rings, and the rings were supposed to rest on the shoulders of priests in front and in back, carrying it off the ground. This is not what was happening. Now, if that had been done, then presumably the ark would not have been endangered as it was on this occasion. The ark on a cart was more jostled and more, in danger of being tossed. And so I believe that had the ark been carried in the way that God had commanded it to be carried, this situation would not have arisen in the first place. Now, where'd they get the idea of carrying the ark on an ox cart? Well, we know that some time earlier, the Philistines had returned the ark to Israel on an ox cart. The Philistines had captured the ark from Israel and found it too hot to handle. And so they wanted to send it back to Israel. So they put it on an ox cart and sent it back to Israel. And it didn't go to Jerusalem at that point, but it went to another place in Israel. It was stored there for a while. Now, when the ark was later to be moved to Jerusalem, why would someone choose to put it on an ox cart instead of carry it the way that Moses said to do it? It would seem like it was a direct imitation of the Philistines' practice. Why would Uzzah or any priest in charge of that project follow the Philistine practice instead of God's orders about this? I don't know. But to be quite honest, I do believe modern churches do the same thing in principle today. I think many times they copy the world's way of conducting worship of God rather than the way the Bible directs it to be done. So maybe Uzzah is not so different than you and me or than the modern church. In any case, if Uzzah was the man in charge, and this is one thing I can't prove, it's my suspicion, it would explain why he was held responsible for the near disaster. If the ark had toppled off into the mud, that would have been a very undignified event to happen to that which represented the glory of God. And if it happened, it would have been strictly because it was not being carried in the manner that God commanded it to be carried. And therefore, it was an act of disobedience to transport the ark on a cart, and it endangered the ark. And, you know, Uzzah might not have been the man in charge, but someone was in charge. Somebody had to make the decision as to how the ark was to be transported. And since Uzzah was standing right there next to it, my guess is he was the guy. And if he wasn't the guy who made the decision, at least he was going along with it instead of correcting it. In any case, the problem that arose here was because the ark was not being carried in the way that God wanted it to be carried. And the fact that God would strike someone down for that might surprise us. But we find that in Leviticus chapter 10, two priests were struck dead supernaturally because they burned the wrong incense, or they burned incense using the wrong coals in the tabernacle, and God struck them down. Now, we might say, well, God's being awfully, you know, peevish here. He's, you know, why is he so particular? Well, God actually, what I understand to be the case is that man does not have an intrinsic right to approach God by any means he wishes. That it's the magnanimous grace of God that allows man to come to God at all. Man is sinful and deserves death because we're rebels against God. That God would let us approach him in any way at all is magnanimity on his part. But he has prescribed the way in which it should be done. And when people ignore the way he said it, it's as if they're saying, well, you know, I know God said that it could be done this way, but I think I'd like to do it this way instead. It's as if we can modify, as if we can innovate, as if we can decide on what terms we will worship God or serve God. And that's an arrogance on man's part that does not take into consideration our sinfulness and our lack of right to access to God. If God gives us some means and says, by this means you can access me, otherwise no. And we say, well, I'm going to access you a different way, the way I want to do it. I'm going to burn strange fire. I'm going to transport the ark how I want to do it, not the way you said. This is a slap in God's face. It's an insult to God. And it's not that God's got thin skin, but he does want to make it very clear that this is not tolerable. And so he did make an example of a couple of priests and of Uzzah in this particular case. At least that's what I think was going on. Now, if someone has a different scenario that they think works better, I'm willing to hear it. But like I said, in order to take this scenario I just gave, you have to presume some things that are not told to us, like what Uzzah's role may have been in this whole situation. But I think it likely that I'm correct on this. I think it's a reasonable assumption, and it's one that cannot be proven or disproven. All right, let's talk to Merrill in Salinas, California. Merrill, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Steve.
Hi.
I am someone like you. I came through the Jesus movement.
Uh-huh.
And I have a question that you might be able to help me with. In the Bible, the story of Isaac,
yep.
his mother Sarah passed away.
Yeah.
And the Lord brought Rebecca, and it says that Isaac was comforted.
Mm-hmm.
Now, is there anything that we can interpret from that story or anywhere else in God's Word how long a mourning period for us human beings should last, or is that just an individual circumstance? Everybody's different. Because my wife passed away not too long ago. So I'm sort of like going through it.
Oh, I'm so sorry. How long ago did your wife pass away?
Almost 3 months ago. So she's with the Lord. She's with the Lord.
Yeah, yeah.
So, you know, the Bible tells us to sorrow not. So I'm trying to live that out.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I myself lost a wife once, you know, and so I know that can be difficult. Well, to mourn the dead is certainly something that has good biblical basis, and when Joseph died, for example, we read that the Egyptians mourned for him for seven days of mourning are mentioned here. That's actually, I think, when Jacob died. But then when Joseph died, they also mourned from him. And I think it's just part of processing the loss. Well, now, I don't think the Bible says how long somebody ought to mourn.
Excuse me, Steve. But isn't it different, the mourning, the style of a mourning, when you lose a spouse compared to a grandfather or mother?
Well, everything is different depending on the dynamics of the relationship. I personally, though I lost a wife to death, I've always felt it would have been harder to lose a child. You know, I mean, it's not easy to lose a wife, but I've often thought there's certain things about losing a child that would be harder still. And for some people, perhaps losing their parents might be harder. It really has to do with the closeness that you've had with the person more than the specific nature of the relationship. After all, a person might mourn the death of a favorite teacher in school who they were close to more than mourning their father who they were never close to. You know, I mean, it really has to do with the relationship. And
why does, I'm not saying why, I know why, but the Bible teaches us that that Jesus said that's why the man should leave his mother and father and cleave unto his wife, and they shall become one flesh. And then in Ephesians, it tells us to love, husbands, love your wives. If we are to become one in union, then what is the purpose that God has in that union in this lifetime when he knows that it's going to bring mourning in some time in the future?
That question really goes much broader. Why does God bring us into this world at all, knowing that there's going to be mourning and loss? Every person who comes into this world is going to lose loved ones. Almost everybody loses their parents in their lifetime. But if they don't, it's only because they themselves died prematurely. And that's another kind of loss. But people lose loved ones. They lose friends. They lose grandparents. They lose parents. They lose children. They lose spouses. Now, it sounds like you're making an argument to convince me that it's okay to mourn for your wife, and I'm saying it is. It is okay to mourn for your wife. I certainly wouldn't say that that's a wrong thing to do. But if you ask why did God bring, why did God cause there to be marriage if we're going to suffer so much when we lose our spouse? Well, I mean, this similar question, why does God allow us to have children when we know that our children are going to die? Some of them may die in our lifetime, but even if they don't, even if we go to our death, we know that we're looking at our children who are going to be dead someday, too. I mean, everybody's going to die. It doesn't make it any easier knowing that necessarily, but it presents the very same kind of dilemma. Why would God bring us into a world and into relationships and into circumstances which are going to bring suffering? Mourning the loss of the dead is only one kind of suffering. There's lots of kinds of suffering. There's physical pain. There's the pain of rejection. By the way, thankfully, your wife didn't divorce you, but only died. I've had a wife die, and I've had another wife divorce me. And I'll tell you, divorce is harder than losing a wife to death because, as you said, your wife is in heaven. You lose a wife in both cases, whether she dies and goes to heaven or whether she divorces you. But when she divorces you, it's even worse. at least in many respects, because you experience not only the loss, but the sense of rejection. You have a lack of closure with a divorce. We actually have closure in the case of a death. In the case of a divorce, you stand the possibility of seeing your spouse with another partner in the future, which will never happen if your spouse dies. You have maybe conflicts over the custody of the kids or the loyalty of the kids. In a divorce, there's all kinds of additional problems besides the loss. In a sense, and I don't say this lightly because I have lost wives both ways, but I would say that losing a wife in death, knowing that she's gone to be with the Lord, is easier to recover from than the other way. But all I'm saying, I'm not trying to diminish at all the pain of losing a wife to death. I'm simply saying that life is full of losses, and everyone loses stuff that's precious to them. But I believe that everything that is of value to us can be restored to us eventually when we go to see Jesus. And so I think maybe one reason that God lets us go through the pain of mourning is it makes us homesick for heaven when we've got loved ones who've gone on ahead. Might make us eager to see them. I know it made me eager to go when my wife died. So, I mean, I don't know. I can't give God all of God's reasons. What I do believe is that there are reasons for God bringing us into a world of suffering. I think suffering has therapeutic benefit to us if we embrace it properly. I think some people suffer and never embrace it, and it doesn't help them at all. But I think the proper embracing of suffering, in fact, makes us more Christ-like, and that's what God's project is for us, to become more Christ-like. Paul said in 2 Corinthians 4 that our light affliction, now Paul's affliction was probably more in the sense of persecution, though we know he had physical pains too, but the loss of loved ones is affliction too. There's all kinds of afflictions. He says our light affliction, which is but for a moment, works for us an eternal and an everlasting weight of glory. He says, while we do not look at the things that are seen, but at the things that are not seen. For the things that are seen are temporal, and the things that are not seen are eternal. So our sufferings, our losses, our griefs, all of them have the potential to work for us in the direction of making us more Christ-like. Now, in talking about that, it may sound like a very hollow thing in talking to somebody who's recently lost a lifelong partner. And like I said, I'm not one who jests at wounds who never felt a scar, or jests at scars that never felt a wound, however Shakespeare said that. I actually have been wounded myself in some of those ways. I also know from experience that God is a comfort in our afflictions, as Paul said in 1 Corinthians 1. In fact, I think some of our afflictions are brought to us so that we might simply find God to be a comfort in them. And we do come to know him better in them. Paul's longed to know Christ in the fellowship of his sufferings. Again, loss of a loved one is a form of suffering. Any form of suffering which this world is full of is capable, if it's embraced properly, of bringing us closer to God. We look to God more when we're lonely after the loss. We have to trust in God when we can't see the sensibleness of the loss. There's all kinds of ways in which our relationship with God can be deepened through suffering, including that terrible form of suffering that you've gone through. And I'm sorry. There's nothing I can say that can make that pain go away. And I do appreciate the fact that you've shared with us. We have other calls waiting. However, Cheryl from Phoenix, Arizona, is next. Cheryl, welcome to the Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hi.
Hi.
I just recently got turned on to your radio show, and I absolutely think you are phenomenal, and you have such a world of knowledge that I could not wait to call you and find out what your take is on this, because my sisters and I go back and forth with it. You know the movie about Heaven Can Wait, or Heaven is for Real? With the little boy?
Yeah.
Well, I listen to Amazing Facts every Sunday with Doug Batchelor, and mm-hmm. he says that is part of believing in mediums when you believe that somebody goes to heaven. He said, no one will see heaven until Christ returns. And until he returns, that's when our bodies will come out of the grave, those that are in the grave. And And I was always brought up, I was brought up in a Christian family, and I was taught that when we die, our spirits right away go to heaven. So that's what I believe, and it's hard for me to believe that it's believing that the devil had something to do with it, because that's what Doug Batchelor says. He says that the devil can make us believe those things because he knows that that little boy had a baby sister that died in her mommy's tummy, and he knows all these things. So he can give those dreams to people, and that's why people come back and have these stories about, I got to go to heaven, but then they got back in their bodies again.
I understand.
And died.
Okay,
what do you believe?
All right. Well, first of all, when Doug Batchelor says that, he's speaking faithfully to his theological system. He's a Seventh-day Adventist, and Amazing Facts is a Seventh-day Adventist organization. And the Seventh-day Adventists believe in what's called soul sleep. They believe that you do not have a spirit that remains alive after you die, but your whole man passes, your whole person passes out of existence or out of consciousness from the time you die until the day that Jesus comes back and raises all the dead. And so they believe that between the time of death and time of the resurrection, there is no consciousness. And that doctrine is called soul sleep because it's suggesting that the soul, as it were, sleeps unconsciously until Jesus comes back. Seventh-day Adventists have always taught this, and it's one of their distinctives that they like to bring up a lot, where they differ from a lot of other Christians. Now, Seventh-day Adventists are not the only people who believe that doctrine. There are other Christians who believe in soul sleep or in conditional immortality and don't believe in soul survival after death, but they do believe in the resurrection at the end of time. So their view would be that when you die, your subjective experience would be, you know, you close your eyes in death and you open them, as far as you know, immediately, but it's not immediate. There may be hundreds of years have passed and you wake up in the resurrection. It's a little bit like if you've ever been put under anesthesia to have some kind of surgery done, how that, you know, you remember them sticking the IV in your arm, and you remember kind of feeling a little drowsy, and then next minute, you know, they say, well, the surgery's done. And you say, what? You know, no time has passed. But it has. You just have been unaware of it. And so if the Seventh-day Adventists are correct about this, then when we die, it's as if we close our eyes one moment, and the next moment we open them, and we're resurrected at the end of the world. And all the time, it may be hundreds of years, may have passed while we were sleeping, so to speak. But it's not been registered. So from our point of view, even in that system, it is as if we immediately have, you know, come to life and go into our eternal state. Now, I don't follow that doctrine myself. I believe, as you do, that the Bible teaches that there is part of us that lives in our body, our conscious self. You might call it the soul or the spirit, or you might divide those two up as two different parts of what the Bible calls the inner man. Lots of different views on this exist, but the main thing is Paul distinguishes between the inner man and the outer man. And he does talk about the possibility of being out of the body. For example, in 2 Corinthians 12, Paul talks about a man who was caught up in the third heaven and saw and heard things that are unrepeatable. And he says he didn't know if the man had this experience in the body or out of the body. In other words, Paul, although he didn't know which it was, he at least believed it was possible for people to have out-of-body experiences, so that there's something conscious in man that can be in the body or it can be out of the body. And when Paul talked about death in Philippians 1 and in 2 Corinthians chapter 5, he spoke of being absent from the body and present with the Lord. Now you can't be absent from the body unless you are something other than your body. I can be absent from my home only because I and my home are not the same thing. My home is a place where I live, and I can be present at home as I am at the moment sitting at my desk, or I can be absent from my home as I was earlier today. In other words, my home is not me. I can be there or not. Me refers to something else. Now, if I can be absent from my body or present in my body, as Paul uses both expressions, or out of the body, Paul used that expression, if those things are possible, then there's something that is me that is not my body and seems to have existence separate from my body, can be present in the body or not. And when Paul addresses the matter of death, he does talk about being present with the Lord and being absent from the body. My own understanding is that when I die, that part of me that's conscious, the inner man, actually goes to be with the Lord and is consciously there until the resurrection. After that, the body will be raised from the dead, and I will live in it again. I'll be present in the body again, but it'll be a glorified body. Now, that's fairly standard evangelical thinking on the subject, and that doesn't mean it's right, because evangelicals have been wrong about things from time to time, and I could be wrong, but this is what I think the Bible teaches, and so that's different than what the Seventh-day Adventists teach.
Okay, well, that really makes me happy, because I think that I believe so much of what you say, because it's what I was raised to believe, that I just needed to be, I needed confirmation that I haven't been believing the wrong thing all this time.
Yeah. Well, but think about it this way. Suppose you and I are both wrong about this, and suppose Doug Batchelor is right. I don't think that's the case, but, I mean, there is a possibility, of course, that I could be wrong, and you could be wrong.
He used Lazarus as an example. When Lazarus died for 4 days and was raised again, he says, don't you think it would have been written in the Bible that he would have had this out-of-body experience? No, nothing like that was written, he said. And
well, why would it have to be written in the Bible if it was?
Well, I don't know.
The Bible doesn't tell us anything about Lazarus's experience, nor Jairus's daughter, nor the son of the widow of Nain. In fact, there's three cases in the Bible of Jesus raising people from the dead in his lifetime, and then of course Peter raised Tabitha from the dead, and Paul raised Eutychus from the dead. There's at least five cases of people being raised from the dead mentioned in the scripture, and not only do they not tell us about an out-of-body experience, they don't tell us anything else about the person either. In other words, the fact of them being raised is the whole purpose of them being mentioned, and whatever they may have said to their friends over dinner the next night is simply unrecorded. We don't read about their experience of dying. That is, we don't know what it felt like to them to die. We don't know what it felt like them to wake up again. So, if there was an out-of-body experience, it's not surprising that we're not told about it. We're not told anything about their experience.
Yeah. Well, good to know. I'm so thankful that I got through today.
I am. I'm glad you did, too, because my lines are full now. All right. Well, thank you for your call.
Uh-huh. Bye-bye.
God bless you, Cheryl. All right. And now the lines are not full. Cheryl's line is cleared, and if you'd like to be on the program, you're listening to The Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg, and if you'd like to be on the program, you may call me at 1-800-438-5090. And I want to just say to our Sacramento area listeners, for many months now, KFIA in Sacramento has been carrying only the second half hour of the program from 2:30 to 3. Just recently, I think probably just last week or the week before, that has changed on Thursdays and Fridays. Now, this isn't a Thursday or a Friday, but tomorrow is a Thursday, and the next day is a Friday. And on Thursdays and Fridays, KFIA in Sacramento is now carrying the whole one-hour program. So while it will still be you'll only be able to listen to the second half hour of the program Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday in Sacramento area, you will be able to listen from 2 o'clock to 3 o'clock, the whole hour, on Thursdays and Fridays. And make sure you tell your friends about that. All right, let's talk next to Catherine from Corvallis, Oregon. Catherine, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Steve, I'm wondering about in Mark chapter 15,
mm-hmm.
Specifically verses 34 and 39. 34 is where Jesus cries out.
Mm-hmm.
And the English translation is, my God, why have you forsaken me?
Yeah.
Or something awfully close to that, probably. And I've just been wondering, I've been with quite a number of people at the end of their lives, and I was thinking about what if somebody I was tending to shouted that as their last statement. And I was thinking that would be really, really hard for the people around. Now, I realize none of these people have been crucified.
Yeah.
And none of these people were Jesus. And so I realize it's significant that he said this. And as uncomfortable as it is, and I realize he was man, he was God, but he was also man, and he gave up being God to be man, to experience life as we did, is my understanding. But would you talk to me a little bit about that ending statement that he made?
I'd be glad to. Well, there's a number of ways this has been looked at. There have been some people who thought, and I think they're completely wrong, that Jesus lost his faith at the last moment there, that he felt like, you know, he had earlier in his life really felt like he was the Messiah, really had believed that, you know, he was the Son of God, really had thought that God was working through him and that the, you know, things were going to work out. But now that he was crucified and clearly dying, he was expressing his despair and disillusionment and perhaps loss of faith. Now, of course, people who say that obviously are not what we call Christians, because they don't believe Jesus is all of that, you know, that he's claimed to be. But this is one way people have taken it. And certainly if you didn't believe in Christ, you could understand those words that way, but it's totally unnecessary to do so. Now, another way to see it would be, as you said, well, since he was a human being, listen, he's going through an agonizing death and he's just crying out in despair. You know, this is horrible. This is painful. And so forth. You know, God, where are you? Why aren't you helping me out of this? In which case, I mean, frankly, we might see Jesus as kind of a whiner. I mean, not that I would do better. I mean, I've never been crucified, and I'd probably be screaming the whole time. But let's face it, lots of people were crucified, not only Jesus. In fact, there were two men crucified at either side of him, and we, you know, the Romans crucified lots of people. I'm sure a lot of them screamed out in agony and despair, but probably some of them took it in a very stoic, you know, macho kind of a way too. You know, if Jesus was just not handling this well, then it's kind of a disappointment to us. We'd wish to have him handle such things with aplomb and with confidence and you know, with courage such as few men would ever have or no other men would have. And yet here we have him, you know, crying out like this. Now, again, I don't think that's the way to see it either. I don't think Jesus was just kind of not handling it well. I believe that when he cried out those words, he was deliberately crying out the first verse of Psalm 22. And you know that he was quoting it. He was quoting Psalm 22:1, my God, why have you forsaken me? Now, this, no doubt, was on David's part. When David wrote Psalm 22, he probably was just crying out in despair because of, you know, disillusionment or whatever for his circumstances. But more than David knew, David, through the Holy Spirit, was speaking prophetically in the person of Christ. And we know as we read further down through Psalm 22 that it describes, you know, they pierced my hands and my feet, my bones are out of joint, they're casting lots for my garment, and so forth. These are all things that happened to Jesus on the cross, and they were spoken of in Psalm 22. And so many people feel, and I think it's very possible, that Jesus was not feeling, you know, total despair, but he was calling attention to those who were within earshot to that psalm by quoting the first verse. They would no doubt be familiar with the psalm from having heard it in their synagogues all their lives. They'd remember, wow, yeah, that's right. This psalm is being played out right before our eyes. It's as if he's saying, I'm in the role David was in Psalm 22, and read about it. You'll see that this was all predicted. You know, this, I'm fulfilling prophecy right here. Now, that is a way that many Christians have understood it. You know, another way that some have understood it is that, of course, he was simply stating the facts that God had turned on him. You know, the view of many is that Jesus, because he took on the sins of the world in his own body, took on the rejection of God. That is God's rejection of him because of sin, but it's not his sin, it's ours. It's God's rejection of us that was being remedied there, and Jesus had to suffer that rejection in our place. And therefore, his cry simply is not so much a question seeking an answer, more of a rhetorical question that is making a declaration that God has now forsaken him. Mm-hmm. And as God would be obliged to forsake mankind if Jesus had not died in their place. But this forsaking of him on God's part was something that was part of the atoning work of Christ. And so many Christians feel that that's why he said it. So there are different views. If you'd ask me which view is correct, I would have to say, I don't know, because I'm not inside of Jesus' head quite in that way, you know. But I can certainly think of some reasonable answers mm-hmm. that do not require the rather, you know, unflattering assessment that some people have made yes. based on his statement.
Yes. So do you believe that because he was taking the sins of the world upon himself, it seems like that in itself would make his death far more horrible?
Well, that's true. I mean, it has been said about that, too, that Jesus' death on the cross was more agonizing than an ordinary death on a cross or death any other way. It was a painful death in itself, but his death on the cross was actually a separation from God, a total separation from God briefly, such as no man has ever endured. You see, even those who don't know God or don't believe in God still benefit from the presence of God. Remember, Jesus said God causes the rain to fall on the just and the unjust and causes the sun to rise on the evil and on the good. God does good things for everybody, including non-Christians. Yes. There's nobody on the planet has lived totally separated from the blessings of God. Mm-hmm. And yet if God was totally forsaking Christ at that moment, Jesus was experiencing the total loss of all things that are comforting, of all things that are pleasant, of all things that are happy. He's going into utter abandonment such as no human being has ever been through before. And so many people feel that that is also why he sweat great drops of blood when he was praying the night before, because he was anticipating this very thing.
Oh, that makes sense. Thank you very much. May I ask you one other?
Okay,
then on verse, thank you very much. That is very helpful. I've been writing as you're speaking. In Mark 15:39, when the centurion says, truly this man was the Son of God, I know it's recorded that there was darkness that fell over the earth, but it's not mentioned right there at the same time that the centurion says that. What is your hunch of what was it? He had just yelled, he'd cried this statement out in verse 34, and then five verses later is when the centurion, when he died, said, truly this man was the Son of God. What is your hunch of what?
Well, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John each record a selection of the things Jesus said from the cross. Altogether, mm-hmm. we know of seven things that Jesus said while he was on the cross. Mm-hmm. He was on the cross for 6 hours. And Mark only really records one of them. Luke records, I think, three of them. Matthew records some of them, and John records some of them. But here we don't have the whole story. We only have a reference to Jesus making that one cry. Mm-hmm. Before the centurion said, truly this was the Son of God, or as it says in Luke, a righteous man, because to a Roman, a son of God wouldn't mean the same thing as to a Christian. A Roman pagan probably used the term son of God to mean an exceptional man. Mm-hmm. But anyway, the point here is that what impressed the centurion was probably not this one statement of Jesus that we have recorded in Mark, but probably Jesus' whole demeanor during the whole 6 hours on the cross, mm-hmm. which included him saying, Father, forgive them. They don't know what they do. And saying to the thief at his side, you'll be with me in paradise. Mm-hmm. And saying, it is finished, and into thy hands I commit my spirit, and so forth. I mean, there was much more to observe of Jesus on the cross than that little snippet that is recorded here in Mark. And the centurion saw it all. We only read a part of it here in Mark. But we get a much bigger picture if we read all four Gospels and see more of what was going on. Mm-hmm. And even apart from that, we don't read 6 hours worth of information in the gospel. So I think Jesus' whole demeanor. He might have even said things that aren't recorded, but there's something about the way Jesus was definitely convinced the centurion there, a Roman pagan, that Jesus was at least a very good man, if not divine. Now, that shouldn't surprise us that the centurion reacted to him that way. Even Pilate, the Roman governor, reacted to him that way.
Yes.
Pilate insisted that Jesus was innocent too, and even may have suspected that he was the Son of God, because there were things that were said that made the Jews said to Pilate, you know, this man's guilty of blasphemy because he said he's the Son of God. Mm-hmm. And it says Pilate was afraid when he heard that. And he took Jesus aside and said, where are you from?
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, it's like Pilate, when the Jews said Jesus claimed to be the Son of God, I think Pilate thought, you know, maybe he is. And and that would be due to a number of things. First of all, Pilate had a chance to observe him and talk to him. But more than that, Pilate's wife had had a dream. And the Romans put great stock in dreams. They were very superstitious about dreams. Mm-hmm. And she said, oh, I was troubled by a dream. Don't hurt this innocent man. Pilate was, you know, probably as ruthless as a Roman centurion, but he was definitely impressed with Jesus in a good way, and so was the centurion.
Hmm.
It's interesting that the pagans were more impressed with Jesus than the Jews were, his own people.
Yes. That is so helpful. Thank you very much.
All right. Well, thank you for your call. Good talking to you.
Bye.
Bye now. Okay. Our next caller is Greg from Jackson, Tennessee. Greg, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Thanks a lot, Steve. Had a question for you. I wanted to know your opinion on Ptolemy's chronology of the Babylonian kings.
Uh-huh.
As you can guess, it's in relation to Daniel's 70
weeks. 70 weeks, right. Mm-hmm.
And I was reading Philip Morrow's book,
and
he was discussing, of course, the difficulties
in
bringing the time up to the time of Jesus, and he pointed out that one of the problems that all of the calculations run into is that every calculation is dependent upon Ptolemy's chronology.
Right.
And if that is wrong, and if every system that we use is dependent on his history, then there's a problem there. So I was wondering what your opinion was on that, and I'll take my answer off the air.
Okay, Greg, thanks for your call.
Thank you.
Good to talk to you. Well, I think Philip Morrow could be correct. We really don't know, because what he's arguing is he's arguing that we don't know. And in that sphere of things that we don't know, it is possible that Ptolemy got wrong the exact length of the Persian reign of the Persians after Cyrus. Now, for those who don't know this problem, it has to do with the 70 weeks of Daniel, because Daniel was told that it'd be 490 years, at least that's how most people understand it, 490 years from the decree to restore and build Jerusalem, which actually Cyrus is the first one who made that decree, until the Messiah, the Prince. Now, there were other decrees made by Artaxerxes, two of them, much later than Cyrus's decree, but Cyrus's decree actually is the first and most closely worded decree to restore and build Jerusalem. And so you'd think it would be Cyrus's decree. But the problem is Cyrus made that decree in 539 B.C. Now, if you measure forward from 539 B.C., 490 years at 70 weeks, you fall short of the time of Christ by 50 years. It brings you up to about 50 B.C. And that's too early for the Messiah. So most people who deal with the 70 weeks of Daniel do not use Cyrus's decree as the starting point, but they use one of the later decrees of Artaxerxes, and some scholars choose the first and some scholars choose the second decree of Artaxerxes, and they measure variously from there, and they end up, you know, bringing the end of the 70 weeks to the time of Christ, pointing him out to be the Messiah. Now, this can be done, but what Philip Morrow argues is that really Cyrus's decree is the one that matches, verbally, the prediction of the command to restore and build Jerusalem. And therefore, Philip Morrow believes that Cyrus's decree is the right decree. But what do you do with the fact that if you measure forward 490 years from Cyrus's decree. You're at about 50, you're about 49 BC. Well, he said it's, or 59 BC. He said that we don't really have the correct information about how long that period was, because the period from the decree of Cyrus to the time of Christ, a certain length of that time was taken up by the Persian rule, the rule of the Persian Empire. Now, after the Persian Empire, there was the Greek Empire, and after that, there was the Roman Empire, and so forth. But the lengths of time of the Greek and the Roman Empires are fairly well documented. The length of time of the Persian Empire, however, is open to question, for the simple reason that Ptolemy, who was an astronomer who lived in the first century A.D., put together the chronologies of the ancient past that are followed by most scholars today. And he listed 10 kings of the Persian Empire. Now, Josephus, I think, listed something like 5 or 6 kings of the Persian Empire, not 10. And Daniel himself, in Daniel chapter 8, seemed to indicate there'd be 3 or 4 kings after Cyrus. So, in other words, how many Persian kings were there? Daniel has the smallest number on record. Josephus has a few more, and Ptolemy has much more, 10 kings. Now, there are no additional records out there to confirm Ptolemy's records or whatever. So the question is, was Ptolemy correct about the length of the Persian reign, or is Josephus correct, or is the Bible correct in Daniel about it? Philip Morrow says he thinks Daniel's correct and that Ptolemy was mistaken. And Ptolemy, of course, lived late enough that he wouldn't have, you know, exact information necessarily and could be wrong, and he was not inspired. But what Philip Morrow has suggested is that Ptolemy's chronology is off by about 80 years. Now, he can't prove that to be true, but he's basing that on his understanding of the 70 weeks of Daniel. That if the Persian rule was 80 years shorter than what Ptolemy said, then that would place the end of the 70 weeks in the time of Jesus Christ. And it would make it more agreeable with what Daniel said about the number of Persian kings, or even more agreeable with what Josephus said about the number of Persian kings. Now, that being so, this theory that Ptolemy was off by 80 years is simply, it's really a theory of convenience, but it could be true. In other words, a person could be cynical about it and say, well, listen, you're just saying Ptolemy was off by 80 years, not because we have any evidence that he was off by 80 years, but because that works out mathematically better to prove Jesus is the Messiah. Fair enough. That is true. But Daniel's so correct on his details in all these other areas, you know, that it is very possible to believe that Daniel was correct and that Ptolemy was incorrect. And so that's what Philip Morrow suggests. What do I think about it? I think Philip Morrow could be right. But he himself would argue that we don't have any proof of it. I mean, this is, it's a matter of faith, really. It's a matter of saying, I trust what Daniel said about how many kings of Persia there were, not what Ptolemy said how many there were. And this makes a difference of some considerable length of time, possibly 80 years. If it is 80 years, then that brings the end of the 70th week right up to the time of Christ in the first century. That's how all that goes, okay? Now, it's strictly a theory, but it is a theory that could be true. We simply lack any proof of it or against it, and so that's about the most I could say about it. It's interesting, though, very interesting, and if you're interested in reading what Philip Morrow has to say about it, he's written a book on the 70 weeks of Daniel. But he's also written a shorter book called The Wonders of Bible Chronology, and he discusses this in both books. Philip Morrow, let me think if I can remember. I think he was the, if I'm not mixing him up with someone else, I think he was the head of the, Library of Congress back in the early 1900s, I think. Anyway, he was a very scholarly Christian man, and he wrote a fair bit on Bible prophecy. I don't necessarily agree with everything he said, but he didn't say many irresponsible things. And so what he said about Ptolemy is plausible. I can't tell you that it's true, but it's plausible. That's probably the most I should say about it. All right, let's talk to Linda from Petersburg, Virginia. Hi, Linda. Welcome.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good.
I was wondering, you're doing a great job, by the way.
Thank
Very
you.
Very informative. Is there such a thing as deja vu?
Is there such a thing as deja vu? I think there is, but I don't know if anyone can explain what causes it. I mean, deja vu simply means seen before or seen again. And it refers to something that you are experiencing or seeing right now or hearing right now, and you think you remember hearing or seeing the same thing at some indistinct time in the past. Mm-hmm. And it really doesn't, it's really kind of impossible to know. Well, I can't say it's impossible. I think people mm-hmm. don't know. I think people don't know what causes mm-hmm. it at this point. What was your interest in it?
I was just wondering, is that, okay, when the Bible says to hold the lamb that was slain before the foundation of the world.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
And then in Isaiah 53, it says, by his stripes ye were healed. We're talking about Jesus, mm-hmm. and it's saying that, you know, by his stripes we were healed, that's past tense. Mm-hmm. And then in Jeremiah, it talks about how he already foreknew Jeremiah before he was formed in his mother's womb. So I was just wondering, is all this is like a deja vu that God already knew us before we were formed in our mother's womb, and we're just going through lack.
Well, some of these, yeah, some of these instances you bring up are, of course, they bring up the question of God's foreknowledge and what he knew in advance and how he knew it and so forth. Certainly the Bible in the prophetic portions of the Old Testament, many times when God's speaking about the future, he uses the past tense. And that is, he describes something as if it's already happened and visible and the prophet has seen it, although he's describing something that's still future. Scholars often refer to this as the prophetic perfect tense because the prophets used it so much. And sometimes they say that it's the reason that it's given in the past tense is because it is so certain that God is going to do it, that it's as good as done. But there's different theories about that. There's different theories about God's foreknowledge and how he knows things. But I don't think that'd be the same thing as deja vu, because deja vu refers to something that takes place in a person's mind. That is, they feel like they've seen or heard or experienced something before, that they're in fact seeing and hearing and experiencing right now. And generally speaking, they don't have any distinct memory of the previous time. It's just kind of a vague feeling that, hey, this is familiar here. I don't remember when this happened. I don't have any association with it in any time frame, but it just doesn't seem like this is the first time. And that's what deja vu usually feels like. And I don't think that would be necessarily related to the phenomena that you're asking about. I'm sorry we're out of time, but I'm glad we got to talk to you. And for those who are waiting and not able to talk to me today, I apologize for that. But you can call tomorrow, Lord willing, and we should have the program going tomorrow and Friday if you'd like to be on the program with your questions. You've been listening to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg, and we do this program Monday through Friday at this same time and the same place you're listening to it right now. So make a habit of tuning in and calling in when you want to discuss questions that are on your mind about the Bible. The Narrow Path is a listener-supported ministry. There's no one on salary here. There's no one receives any money, but we do have to pay money. We don't get paid to be on there. We pay to be on there. We have to buy the time from radio stations, and we depend on the Lord to provide for that to keep us on the air. And that usually comes from people like you. If you'd like to help us stay on the air, you can write to The Narrow Path, P.O. Box 1730, Temecula, California, 92593. Or go to our website, thenarrowpath.com. Thanks for joining us.